This is tape 4, October the 5th. Now, Mr. President, we were talking about Jefferson and...
You were talking about his trying to introduce the metric system, having introduced the decimal system for coinage.
That's right.
And also the conservation measures that he first fostered in his own state of Virginia and wanted to adopt them nationally, but didn't have much success with it.
That's right. He was very much interested in agriculture. And in fact, you can't find anything in which the welfare of the people was at stake in which Jefferson was not interested. And he was an inventor, a great inventor of his period.
May I go back to the Declaration of Independence, which was a great revolutionary document and still is in many ways a revolutionary document. Why didn't it have greater influence throughout the world as, say, some of the material which came out of the French Revolution?
Well, it did. It was one of the reasons for the French Revolution, the Declaration of Independence of the United States, and it's been a reason for revolutions all around the world. That and the Constitution of the United States are the most revolutionary documents that were ever written, and the fundamental basis of the feeling is in the Declaration of Independence, which was written by Thomas Jefferson as an amanuensis, but it was gone over and certain suggestions made by Franklin and several other members of the Continental Congress before it was adopted. The original draft of the Declaration of Independence you find pretty well scratched up with recommendations that are made for its improvement, and they were improvements.
Well, now, Mr. Jefferson had many appointments abroad. You've just indicated that some of our men who were overexposed to foreign influence came back with rather conservative ideas, but he had a good deal of exposure.
That was in relation to Adams.
That's right.
Jefferson's idea, of course, was in conformity with the Declaration of Independence, which he had had the greatest hand in writing. And his interests and his visits to France were in the creation of a free government that would work. He also was interested in architecture. He brought back the plans for the Virginia Capitol from a little temple at Nimes, in France. And he also found the building in Italy just outside of Venice, a short distance, which is the model on which he built the Monticello House. He was interested in everything. There never was a man, I think, with more interests than Jefferson had. Even to this day, you don't find men with as many interests as Jefferson had in his day.
Yet, would you call him the first egghead in the White House?
Well, if you want to name a man who has the knowledge of all sorts of things and who is well-versed in history and everything else, an egghead, he was one.
He was a brilliantly educated man.
Brilliantly educated man, and then was a graduate of William & Mary College and a lawyer, and most everything you want to name in that day, except he was not a doctor of medicine, although he could have been. But Jefferson had an idea that knowledge was the most important thing that a man could have, and he tried to attain as much of it as he could. And while he could be named an egghead, he was a practical egghead. He knew how to make things work on the ground as well to read and talk about them.
Now, he drafted the first constitution for the state of Virginia.
That's right.
But he also drafted some document for France, didn't he? A document of a Bill of Freedom or something?
I think he did. I think he had a hand in the drafting of the bill in the French Revolution known as the Bill of Freedom. I don't know what effect he had or how much of it he did.
Now, with all that experience, did he have time to, and with all of his interests, did he have time to maintain working relations with the Congress?
He did. He had the closest working relations with the Congress, and they had the greatest respect for him. He also carried on a tremendous correspondence. I found one letter of his not long ago in which he said he was a slave to his writing table. He kept up with his correspondence, and he did it all longhand, and I don't see how in the world he ever did it. There are two full volumes of the letters which passed between him and John Adams, and that was only a part of the correspondence that he carried on.
Was he a genial man, or was he a serious man?
Apparently, he was a very genial man, and then a good man to have around in any sort of company. He knew how to make people enjoy themselves. In fact, He was too much that way for the simple reason that his friends ate him out of house and home, and he lost all his property because he couldn't keep up with the expense of running it. His house as a kind of a hotel.
And yet he read a lot and wrote a lot, talked a lot.
I don't know how he got all
that. How do you account for all that activity within a 24-hour day?
Well, it's because he liked to do it. And he was a man who had a wonderful library. He had one of the finest libraries in the whole Western Hemisphere. And the reason it was a great library, whenever he went abroad, he always added some books to it that he thought were necessary for a man to understand and read. And that library was finally the foundation of the Library of Congress. It's in the Library of Congress in toto.
And then he was a man of extraordinary culture, but there was something else to him. Now, what was the drive in him? What was the
Well, he was just a good human being, and he liked people, and he liked to associate with people, and he liked to get along with people, and he liked to discuss all questions with anybody who was willing to discuss them with him on any subject he wanted to bring up. And he knew all the top-notch people in Virginia and in New York and Massachusetts and in France and England, too, for that matter.
Very gregarious, then, wasn't
he? Yes, he was.
Well, Mr. President, although he may have been an egghead, nevertheless, he was a man of action, as indicated by his Louisiana Purchase.
About that. He was not only a man of action, but when he denunciated certain principles and he found out they didn't work, he was perfectly willing to change them. That he did when he bought Louisiana.
Did he have any special interest abroad after he became president?
I don't think so. He carried on correspondence with a great many people abroad, but I don't think he had any special interest abroad after his visits over there previous to the time he was president.
Well, there was a lot of problems with Tripolitania in those days, and he got involved in some difficult activities, piracies abroad, didn't he?
Well, I don't remember whether that's in his administration or not.
Adams.
Barbary pirates were eliminated, but I think that was after Jefferson went out of office.
After Jefferson.
Could be. I'm pretty sure that went after he went out of office.
Now, Washington was definitely withdrawn from any of the, what he called the entangling alliances, definitely isolationist.
In Washington's time, the difficulties were very acute between France and Britain. And Washington's attitude on foreign affairs was to keep the United States from becoming involved in a foreign war between Britain and France. And that was one of the reasons for the Alien and Sedition Laws, was to keep from becoming involved in those affairs. But finally, James Monroe enunciated a policy in the 1820s, the early 1880s. Well, let's see, he was president from about till 1824, and 8 years previous to that. He enunciated the policy which warned foreign powers not to attempt to establish colonies in the Western Hemisphere as a result of all these things that had taken place beforehand. You remember Jefferson was, what in this day would be called a very liberal person in his thoughts. He thought a man had a right to his own belief in religion and his own actions privately in his own affairs. And he became in the campaign, one of the campaigns called a Jacobin, which is about the same as being called a communist these days. But the only reason they called him that was for political purposes. He was a first, last, and all the time, a man who believed in the American government and the government of the United States as it's been set up under the Constitution. He tried his best to enforce that Constitution to the best of his ability and to make it work to meet emergencies, which he did when he purchased Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. I want to try to get at is, would you rate him as a nationalist in the sense that Washington and Adams were, or was he beginning to show signs of internationalism?
Well, he was a nationalist in this way, that he believed the federal government was superior to any government in the United States. But he also believed that their function of the state government should not be overlooked. And he's had been charged with having been a man who believed in strict construction of the Constitution. And as far as the Constitution affects the affairs of the states, he was a strict constructionist. But when it came time for the Constitution to be applied to foreign affairs, he was a liberal constructionist. He believed that the necessary things that had to be done in international affairs could be done under the Constitution.
All right. Now then, he inherited some slaves and inherited quite a sizable farm, did he not, from his father?
Well, he inherited a tremendous amount of land from his father, and he accumulated a tremendous amount of land after that. And at his death, though, he freed all his slaves. He was in favor of stopping the slave traffic in 1809, when the Constitution was adopted, but it was not accomplished.
But he freed all of his slaves?
He freed all his slaves when he died.
Where did Jefferson get all the, how did he earn his money? How did he come into possession?
He was a Virginia plantation, raised tobacco and everything else that goes on the farm, was very successful at it. And of course he was so liberal that anything that he accumulated soon disappeared with the people who were begging from him and asking him to take care of him and all that kind of business. And he had a tremendous number of family connections which he felt he was responsible for and was in a certain way. But when he died, all his property was gone. He didn't leave any estate of any kind at all to speak of.
He had very liberal views regarding religion, didn't he also write
Well, there's a book called The Jefferson Profile, in which you will find a statement and an article by Jefferson in which he states exactly what his views are. And he was a member of the Episcopal Church of Virginia, but he didn't believe in a state church of any kind. But Jefferson had a view of religion that's perfectly legitimate and all right. I think he was a good man in every way.
Did he write an abridged version of the Bible?
He took out all the directions for the proper kind of a life out of the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles and some of the epistles and put them together in what's known as Jefferson Bible. And it's good reading.
Now, he also prepared a parliamentary manual. What was
Jefferson's
that?
Manual, he did that while he was Vice President of the United States, and that's the manual under which the transactions of the Senate and the House of Representatives are carried on with amendments which fit the day and the age. But Jefferson's manual is a fundamental basis of parliamentary procedure.
And that's still in operation?
Still in operation. It's in the Senate manual. Every senator is supposed to read it when he first comes there.
Now, this would rate Mr. Jefferson as perhaps the most accomplished and the most gifted man that ever occupied the White House, in your judgment, would it?
Well, let's name him as the most versatile.
Versatile.
In all lines. You rate competence by certain other things. He had competence and everything else of that kind, but I think he was about the most versatile occupant the White House has ever had in connection with everything that had to do with the operation of a government during the period that he lived, all the way from the time of the Continental Congress down to the date of his death in 1823, I think it was, or 25.
Just as a sideline on him, did he bear any grudges or carry on any feuds with anyone?
No, the only feud that was ever carried on between Jefferson and the only feud that was ever carried on with him was carried on by John Adams when he left the White House at midnight. But that was all smoothed over, and he and Adams became the greatest of friends. And the last words of John Adams when he died on the 4th of July was, "The country's safe, Jefferson still lives," and Jefferson was dying at the same time.
That's the end of tape for October 5th.
Well,
this is tape 5, the morning of October the 5th. Hi, Mr. President.
He, you describe him as a very versatile man. What particular talent did stand out in this man's making?
His understanding of free government and how it can be made to work, I think, is the most outstanding contribution that Jefferson made to the history of the United States.
In retrospect, would you say that made a special contribution to the evolution of this nation out of proportion to that of any of his predecessors?
Yes, any question about that. He was responsible for the establishment of a government in the hands of the people, which the Constitution says is where the power of government resides. And he tried his best to carry out that principle in the Constitution. It starts off with that very statement.
Now, he had no difficulty at all getting a second term.
No, I don't think he had any opposition for a second term, if I remember correctly.
some minor opposition. Didn't Pinckney come up again?
He might have had some opposition, but I don't remember.
Was his second term more productive than his first?
I think it was a continuation of his first term, and I don't know of any other outstanding things in that second term, unless the Louisiana Purchase came in that term. It didn't, though, because that Louisiana Purchase, I think, was made in 1804 or 5, in his first term.
1803.
Well, that is right shortly after Napoleon had taken it over from Spain.
I'd like to jump about 100 years down to a man, Nixon, who keeps saying that the modern Democrats are betraying the principles of Jefferson, eliminating his demagoguery and his deceit. What is Nixon trying to say?
He's trying to say that Jefferson would not agree with the Democrats at the present day. And I'm just as sure as I sit here that if Jefferson were alive, he'd be in a line completely alongside the Democrats, the Democratic Party as it is today, because it's fundamentally the basis on which free government is founded. The Democratic Party, it goes back to the time of Thomas Jefferson, shortly after the Revolution, and is based on the fact that the Constitution means what it says, that the power of government is in the people. I think Jefferson would be a good Democrat if he were alive today.
Well, the reason I ask that is to emphasize what it is that Jefferson did and said, which still lives on today and is important.
He was of the opinion and lived by it that the power of government is in the people, all the people and not just a few. And that's always been the principle of the Democratic Party. Of course, after every one of these great men, Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, any of the others that you want to name, they were usually followed by a bunch of presidents who were not so much interested in the Constitution as a governmental document which the president is supposed to enforce, but were of the opinion that the Congress ought to go ahead and make any laws they felt like, and that's all the present men had to do was to enforce them. But that's not the case at all. The great presidents are those presidents who made the Constitution fit the emergencies that they came up while they were in the office.
Jefferson then was, in a sense, ahead of his time, was he not?
No, I don't think he was ahead of his time. I think that the work that Washington had done in establishing a stable government was simply carried on by Jefferson after he became president. Adams hadn't made any approach of that sort to the enforcement of the Constitution of the United States, and Jefferson was only carrying on the effect that Washington had created in establishing a firm and stable government. Jefferson kept that government running. So did Andrew Jackson.
But Jefferson was the first liberal president.
He was the first president who believed that the power of government is in the hands of the people themselves, not in the hands of just a few at the top notch of the economic program.
Now, as long as you were projecting them 100 in terms of their possible function now, would Washington have been the conservative president during this period as he was during his own?
You never can tell. That's another hypothetical question. But Washington, I'm sure, would have done what he thought was the right thing, whether people agreed with him or not. He was a very unpopular president. In fact, he was more roundly abused than any other president that was ever in the White House. That's one of the reasons he quit.
Was he abused by the people, the press,
the
or
press.
Just
he
the Congress?
He was roundly abused by the press and certain members of the Congress. In fact, under ordinary conditions, had Washington not been president of the United States, there isn't a doubt but he would have fought some duels with some of the men who made the meanest remarks about it.
How was Jefferson treated by the press?
Same way. They abused Jefferson roundly, as they did Jackson. The press has always abused the great president. And the reason for the abuse is because they do things. And the press has special interests which they want to see done some other way, and of course then they abuse the man who carries out the situation for the benefit of all the people in the country. Every great president has been roundly abused by the press.
Is that the... do you know of any special reason why the press would abuse a great president?
Well, of course, they want to sell papers. And when you take the top-notch man in a great republic and throw bricks at him, you know the people are going to buy the papers and read them, and then they can sell more advertising. That's principally what's behind their attitudes. I don't think any of them have any serious principles that they want to enforce, although a great many of the editors of the great papers are great men and have always been. Take Horace Greeley and old James Gordon Bennett and old man Dana. They were as mean as they could possibly be as far as their papers are concerned, but they made a contribution to the free press of the country.
Well, in that sense, the press had never been on the side of the people, then, according to you.
Well, they claim that they're on the side of the people. They're on the side of the people that support them. And they try to make things appear to the communities which they serve as that their position is the right one, and the executive may, in all cases, be wrong, but that is the case in the long run. If the executive knows what he wants to do and goes ahead and does it, well, they'll eventually support him when the time comes. Now, every president, after he's been dead 50 years, the great ones particularly, they begin to find out just what he did and why he did it. And then the attitude has changed, but they're not selling advertising in that day then.
Well, the role of the press then is very unique in American history, as it is in all modern history, in that it plays a role which can only be paralleled with constitutional setups.
That's correct.
The press receives no mandate from the people nor God, and yet they play a terrific role in molding
events. That's right. They have a very great influence with people who are not conscious of the background that makes a government great. And it's a good thing, because no newspaper program that I can ever find in the history of the country has ever done any real harm to the country. And they dig up a lot of things sometimes that ought to be dug up, and they make a great stir about them, and they're usually corrected. But the objective of the press is to sell papers and advertising, and you've got to keep that always in mind. Now, the little country papers in the little counties and towns, the little dailies that are operated and owned by the editor himself, are the only free press in the country.
Well, yet the newspapers that have got the greatest circulations were the ones that, in their early days, like Pulitzer and Hearst, they did a lot of muckraking. They dug up a lot of scandal against the privileged people, against the bankers and the railroads and so on.
One of my favorite examples of that situation is the old Medill's paper in Chicago, who reported Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as another time when the President of the United States made an ass of himself.
Well, then, what you're saying, in effect, is that the newspapers have not always judged correctly the effect of...
Oh, no, they're like every other human being. Their objective, as I say, is to sell newspapers, and a thing of that sort usually sells a lot of papers. And I don't have no objection to it, as long as they don't fool the people too much.
Well, Mr. President, in making this sort of generalized blanket charge against the press, what you have in mind is certain outstanding members of the press, or
the metropolitan press is what I'm talking about as a whole.
Yes, you're not saying that all of the press is that way, but it's.
Well, I'm saying that if you read the, you see the press make their impressions by the front page and the headlines on all the great newspapers. We have some very great newspapers in the country. You want to turn over and read the back pages, and then you'll find out really what goes on.
Now, what you're saying is that they are not informing the people. They're not reporting. They're propagandizing in a large sense.
And a great many of them are. That's not true of all of them. But you find that the prejudice of the editors appears on the front page in headlines and sometimes in garbled news. Now, there are several papers in the country whose news reports are exactly as factual as they can be made. The hardest thing in the world to find when you're hunting for it is fact. And some people have different ideas of what the fact is. But eventually, when the whole thing is taken into consideration, the information that the people get through free press, a so-called free press, is perfectly all right, because there are very few of the people that they can continue to fool all the time.
Is that why Jefferson wrote so voluminously to many people?
Yes, I think that's one of the reasons that he wanted to leave a record of exactly how he felt on all subjects. And he did it very well and very carefully.
So he too had a very bad press.
Oh yes, he had every great president had a bad press.
Well now, how do you cope with it? In these days, the president can now get on a microphone or call a press conference. In those days, there were no press conferences.
No, press conferences didn't start until Woodrow Wilson's time. But the very fact that a man can have the presidential office can have a press conference and can have a chance to talk to the whole country over radio and television hookups makes the press much more careful about the reporting that they do, because the people have a way of finding out what the truth is more quickly than they did in the past. That's the only difference.
Well, Jefferson was handicapped then. There was no way he could mobilize public opinion on any of his proposals.
Except by his letter writing. He did it by his letter writing. And that's how he organized the Democratic Party. They called it the Republican Democratic Party in that time, because it was a party who believed in the Republic.
May I suggest there, Dave, that when you say mobilizing, you're using a very modern expression, aren't you? Because after all, mobilizing public opinion in that time was not so instantaneous as it is today.
Let's use the word organizing. He organized public opinion.
Right.
And that's the way he did it, with his correspondence. He wrote to people all over the country at that time, from Massachusetts to Georgia.
Did a question of a third term come up with Jefferson?
I don't think so. I don't think he won the third term. I think he was perfectly happy to retire when the time came, just as Washington was.
He felt that he had had it after two terms.
That's right.
And there was no clamor for him to run a third time?
I don't know. I don't think there was. I think that the Virginia organization had decided on James Madison, Jefferson's Secretary of State, and there was no opposition to it.
And did he have a hand in the selection of Madison?
In the selection of Madison, the selection of Monroe. But not in John Quincy Adams or Andrew Jackson.
Now, when...
In other words, his influence stopped with Monroe.
With Monroe, that's right. And I think that's been true of all the people who held the great offices. Their influence doesn't last very long after they're out of office. And it's proper and right that it shouldn't, because there's no chance of a dictatorship.
Well, parenthetically, we don't agree.
Well, he's making an important point. You don't think that should be, because that's a sort of a prolongation of a certain...
That's right.
...influence.
Certain influence that probably shouldn't be there.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. President, this is the end of Paper 5.
Well, I'll go and sign about 700 letters.